"My dear Jane," exclaimed Elizabeth, "you are too good. Your sweetness and disinterestedness are really angelic. I do not know what to say to you. I feel as if I have never done you justice or loved you as you deserve." Miss Bennet eagerly disclaimed all extraordinary merit and threw back the praise on her sister's warm affection. This is the After-Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. One of the exemplary friendships we studied at the 2019 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought was the friendship between Elizabeth Bennet and her sister Jane in Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. What characterized this friendship between two women? Why is their relationship so appealing? And what can we learn from it to inform our own friendships? Wyoming Catholic College teaching fellow Dr. Tiffany Schubert has been a Jane Austen fan and scholar for many years. Here is her presentation, delivered this past June 10th.
I like to begin by reading a prayer from Jane Austen, actually just a very brief excerpt from one of her prayers, in which she asks God, quote, "Give us grace to attain that temper of forbearance and patience which, while it prepares us for the spiritual happiness of the life to come, will secure to us the best enjoyment of what this world can give." In this prayer for happiness, both spiritual and temporal, I think we see something of Austen's deepest concerns, both as a Christian and as an artist. She's profoundly engaged in the question of what constitutes human flourishing. David and Jonathan, Achilles and Patroclus, these are both friendships that end with a tragic loss of the beloved friend, whether that be through external circumstances or perhaps in part because, as Glenn was suggesting, something in honor itself is maybe destructive to friendship. And these are losses that are marked by great lamentation that we get from David and we also get from Achilles. With Jane Austen, we move from tragic friendship to comic friendship. We move from the severing of friendship to the permanent possession of it within The Happy Life. So the friendship that we get little glimpses of between Jane and Elizabeth Bennet in the reading selections continues to the end of the novel and actually beyond the end of the novel. Nobody dies. Generally, very few people die in Jane Austen, in general. And when they die, their death is very convenient for the happiness of others. I think in order to understand this happy friendship within Jane Austen, I think we have to first briefly situate her within the history of happiness and sort of think about the relationship that friendship bears to happiness. We sort of had this idea of friendship and honor. I'm going to talk a little bit about friendship and happiness. So I'm going to cheat a little bit and quote from Aristotle, who we're actually talking about a little bit later. Aristotle writes, quote, "Happiness, more than anything else, seems complete without qualification, for we always choose it because of itself, never because of something else." Boethius, who's a 6th century politician and author and philosopher, whom we also read here at WCC, Boethius writes, "Happiness is man's one overall concern. This is the good which once attained ensures that no one can aspire to anything further. Indeed, it is the highest of all goods and gathers all goods within itself." Some 700 years later, Thomas Aquinas concurs with both Aristotle and Boethius when he says, "Happiness is the perfect good which wholly brings desire to rest, for it would not be an ultimate end if something should still remain to be desired." Adam Smith, in his Theory of Moral Sentiments, which is a work that Jane Austen most likely read, he declares, "The happiness of mankind seems to have been the original purpose intended by the author of nature when he brought them into existence. No other end seems worthy of that supreme wisdom and divine benignity which we necessarily ascribe to him. And this opinion, which we are led to by the abstract considerations of his infinite perfections, is still more confirmed by the examination of the works of nature, which seem all intended to promote happiness." So, the history of happiness tells us happiness is the good which we choose for its own sake. Right? We want health for the sake of happiness. We never want it. Happiness for the sake of health. The end is happiness. It's the highest good that includes all of the other goods. Nothing is left out in happiness. It's this combination of all of the goods that human beings desire. It's actually the satisfaction of all of our desires. We're not in this constant state of desiring. And according to Adam Smith, it's the reason that God made us. We are created for happiness. happiness in this tradition, it is the very purpose of human beings. So I think that Jane Austen needs to be situated in this tradition. So I actually want to return to her prayer and look at it a little more closely. I'll read it again. Give us grace to attain that temper of forbearance and patience, which, while it prepares us for the spiritual happiness of the life to come, will secure to us the best enjoyment of what this world can give. So we see in this prayer, as she mentions, two virtues, the virtue of forbearance and the virtue of patience. And those virtues have a twofold effect. The first, heavenly happiness, and the second, present enjoyment. Now, I think her prayer probably intimates the superiority of spiritual happiness over the life to come, right? Spiritual happiness of the life to come over what this world can give. We can kind of see where my allegiances are in that, as a literary scholar, right? We're of this world. And Austen, as a novelist, her primary concern is temporal happiness. She's not going to take us up into heaven with Dante. So her novels ask, what makes for the good life here? And I think we see in this prayer, right, there's this suggestion of virtue, forbearance and patience. So virtue prepares us for heavenly happiness and secures present enjoyment. I think she, like Aristotle, sees virtue as indispensable for true happiness. I think she's also going to say that virtuous friendship is an indispensable part of that happiness. For Aristotle, friendship is the greatest of the external goods. Austen most likely did not read Aristotle. She has this intuitive Aristotelianism that she somehow picked up but probably not from him. But she did read and love Samuel Johnson, who was the great lexicographer, essayist, and moralist of the 18th century. Her brother Henry tells us that Johnson was, quote, Austen's favorite moral writer in prose. So she loves moral writers, and she loves prose. In a letter, she refers to him as my dear Dr. Johnson. According to Johnson, quote, life has no pleasure higher or nobler than that of friendship. So Austen is reading these great moralists, these great thinkers on the nature of friendship. Now, I'm not quite sure whether she would classify friendship as the highest pleasure, but I think that she prizes it extremely highly. So at the end of Pride and Prejudice, Jane and Elizabeth, these two sisters, find happiness with the respective men of their dreams, Mr. Bingley and Mr. Darcy, who come up in our readings. And we get a description of their marriages and what happens to everyone. And amongst this catalog of laying out all the happiness that everyone has found, we get this little detail from the narrator. And she tells us, Jane and Elizabeth, in addition to every other source of happiness, were within 30 miles of each other. Right. I think every other source of happiness here suggests that Boethian idea that happiness gathers all the goods into itself. Right? Every other source, including this source as well. So multiple sources of happiness. And then that phrase, in addition to every other source, I think that suggests a kind of completion. So on top of all of the other sources of happiness, and these girls really do get a lot, got great men, both of them who are very financially secure. They've been delivered from a home that's not necessarily the most intellectually stimulating of homes. They themselves have grown in excellence and virtue. They've got a lot. Both of them have carriages. In the 19th century, the height of what you aspire to. In addition to all of that, they're close to each other. So then this physical proximity is the crowning achievement of their happy friendship. But I want to look closely at what kind of friendship this is, this friendship that ends in 30 miles distance from each other. Which, right, is a long way in the 19th century, but again, they both have carriages, so they're good, right? They can get to each other closely. Right, so what kind of friendship did Jane and Elizabeth have? Well, of course, they're sisters. And so they come. They're sisters. They come from a large family. We've got five girls in this family. Jane and Elizabeth are the eldest, and they're definitely the best. The three other sisters are take them or leave them. Yeah. It's a little unfair. Kitty actually grows in virtue and maturity by the end. Mary pretty much remains the same. It's kind of this dour moralist who likes to go around quoting moral truisms. People have often said that pride is a bad thing. This is the kind of insightful moral commentary that we get from Mary. And then Lydia, the youngest child, runs away, elopes with Wickham, causing so much of the problem, the drama of Pride and Prejudice, but also in the end, facilitating the final reconciliation between Elizabeth and Darcy. So they're sisters. They're the eldest sisters. And in the 18th century, the relationship between siblings was considered a kind of friendship. I'm going to quote Adam Smith again. Yeah. He says, "The earliest friendships, the friendships which are naturally contracted when the heart is most susceptible of that feeling, are those among brothers and sisters." So I think this quotation is interesting for a couple of reasons, being this idea that the connection of friendship and feeling, and this is why friendships at a young age work so well, because you're most susceptible to the feelings that develop and lead to friendship. He also says their good agreement, that between siblings, while they remain in the same family, is necessary for its tranquility and happiness. Right? You gotta have siblings. Siblings have to get along. They have to be friends in order for the home to be tranquil and happy. In Mansfield Park, which is a novel that Austen publishes a year after Pride and Prejudice, though it's written much later than Pride and Prejudice is, Austen describes two siblings reunited after many years. She writes, "All the evil and good of their earliest years could be gone over again, and every former united pain and pleasure retraced with the fondest recollection. An advantage this, a strengthener of love, in which even the conjugal tie is beneath the fraternal. Children of the same family, the same blood, with the same first associations and habits, have some means of enjoyment in their power, which no subsequent connections can supply." I think this sounds a little bit astounding to us as modern audiences, accustomed as we are to think of the conjugal tie as the closest. But Austen here is saying, with respect to the power of recollection, love between siblings is superior to love between spouses. We can share memories with our siblings that our spouses simply do not have access to. And those memories are some of our first memories. And there's something up in the 18th century and in Austen, something about firstness, primariness, that's really key. Our first associations and habits. But being a member of the same family and having the same blood by no means guarantees friendship. Elizabeth and Jane are not friends with Mary, Kitty, or Lydia. There's a sort of weird, unhealthy friendship between Lydia and Kitty, the two youngest, in which Lydia is basically the corrupting influence on Kitty. So being a sibling is by no means a guarantee that you're going to be friends. So I think their friendship is certainly, this is an element of it, but it goes beyond just that intimate sibling connection, primary associations, and first memories. So their siblings, they're also women. And so we'll talk a little bit about female friendship. Now, female friendship has often been viewed with skepticism. Montaigne, the great French essayist, writes, quote, "Women are in truth not normally capable of responding to such familiarity and a mutual confidence as sustain that holy bond of friendship, nor do their souls seem firm enough to withstand the clasp of a knot so lasting and so tightly." We just sort of can't endure the emotional intensity that is friendship. There's a sort of there's a fragility. There's a fragility to them. Their friendships don't succeed. And if we look at our literature, I think we often see women isolated and alone, and not often paired together as friends. Helen has no female confidant in the Iliad. Penelope is surrounded by male suitors. Athena's there helping her, but she doesn't realize this. So she doesn't have the comfort of a female friend. If we move into the Middle Ages, in the courtly love tradition there, the woman is the isolated beloved. She might have a faithful maid who's kind of there helping her get together with a guy, facilitating their love affair. It's a bit of a stretch, I think, to call them friends. So she's the problematic Guinevere of Arthurian legend, right? The desired woman, but the woman alone. Now, there are, of course, exceptions to this. We have Ruth and Naomi, who I think are a beautiful example of female friendship in the Old Testament. And Shakespeare, that great reader of all human nature, male or female, or both, is an important influence. He's actually an important influence in Austin, and he gives us female friendships. So you think Rosalind and Cecilia, Helena and Hermia. Now, by the time we get to the 18th century and into Austin's own world, we are actually getting representations of female friendship. I think in part because the novel has become so popular by the time Austin's writing, and the novel's a female genre. Right? Women are writing novels, women are being depicted in novels. So we're getting female friendship. Now, that female friendship that's being emphasized and represented in the novel tends to be rather sentimental. So if any of you have read Northanger Abbey, this is a little short novel that Austin writes, she makes fun of this kind of friendship. This is a sort of friendship in which women exchange tearful embraces, effusive declarations over how much they love each other, over how wonderful the other person is. So this is sort of the dominant image of female friendship. And an Austin scholar by the name of Janet Todd ascribes this to Rousseau. So actually I should back up just a little bit, right, and point out this is not this idea of female friendship is intensely sentimental, right, as a sort of right, effusive emotional outpouring, arises in part because this is how women are seen in the 18th century. So you have this idea that women are sentimental and men are rational. And so much of this is coming from Rousseau. So Todd writes, in Emile, Rousseau, who's the most influential philosopher of the period, separated the qualities and gave reason to his hero and sensibility to his heroine. Right, so this is a philosophical and a literary division between the male and the female. Mary Wollstonecraft, so great, great 18th century feminist author. She critiques male philosophers who, quote, labored to prove with chivalrous generosity, right, here's being pretty sarcastic here, that the sexes ought not to be compared. Man was made to reason, woman to feel. Right, and so this dichotomy between the sexes affects the way that female friendship is represented. And I think that Austin, with every fiber of her being, resists this dichotomy. She does not buy into the simplistic, men are rational, women are feeling. Nor do I think Austin is particularly concerned with male friendship versus female friendship. I think she's just interested in friendship. And I think she wants to show us that women are capable of that kind of friendship. And she does this in Pride and Prejudice by giving us this friendship between Elizabeth and Jane that's vibrant and attractive. It's not sickly and sort of an emotional indulgence that's almost kind of comical. This is not that. She shows us that women as rational beings are capable of the same kind of intimate and virtuous attachment that men are. She shows us, I think, that the friendship between Elizabeth and Jane, while certainly based on deep affection for the other, goes beyond that. Right? Their friendship is based on their admiration for the goodness of the other, on their shared sense of virtue, not just sense of virtue, but their ability to act virtuously, and to appeal to moral principles. I think, and also in their confidence in the good sense of the other. The scenes that we get between the two of them are conversations. They are confiding conversationally, linguistically, in each other. They trust each other. But for all the admiration and the virtue and the good sense, friendship is not simply a serious affair for Jane Austen. I think she also shows us how friendship invites and is furthered by linguistic playfulness. I think we see this particularly in the way that Elizabeth speaks to Jane. Elizabeth is a playful character, but this is also a part of their friendship itself. Okay, so I want to start by looking at. So this is after Jane has been getting to know Mr. Bingley, who's a rather wealthy man who's come into the country for the purpose of purchasing a estate, but he's let out Netherfield Hall, sort of a local nearby house. And so Jane and Mr. Bingley have been getting to know each other and seem to have been falling in love. She spends almost a week at his house because of the machinations of her mother, who sends Jane out alone in the cold and the wet and the damp. And Jane, being a heroine, one of the heroines, right, of a 19th century novel, naturally, of course, gets sick. You can't go outside in the 19th century, right, alone and not get sick. But again, this is Jane Austen, so everybody's sickness is very convenient, ultimately, right, for the happiness of the whole. She gets sick, she spends almost a week with the Bingleys, with Mr. Bingley and his sisters. Elizabeth ends up coming to the house and also staying so she can tend and care for Jane. So they've actually spent more time with each other than just simply a few balls or a few dinners. And things seem to be going well. There seems to be this intense, this genuine love that's developing between Bingley and Jane. And then suddenly, she gets a letter. And the letter is from Bingley's sister, Caroline, informing her that they are leaving. They're going to London. And they're probably not coming back. Okay. So this is where we are in this scene here. So, can I get someone to read Jane and someone read Elizabeth? I'll read the narrator. So, I'm looking at, it's page 43 in the packet, 134 in the book itself. I'll start, a day or two passed. So, a day or two passed before Jane had courage to speak of her feelings to Elizabeth. But at last, on Mrs. Bennet's leaving them together, after a longer irritation than usual about Netherfield and its master, she could not help saying,
"Oh, that my dear mother had more command over herself. She can have no idea of the pain she gives me by her continual reflections on her. But I will not repine. It cannot last long. He will be forgot, and we shall all be as we were before."
Elizabeth looked at her sister with incredulous solicitude, but said nothing.
"You doubt me,"
cried Jane, slightly coloring.
"Indeed, you have no reason. He may live in my memory as the most amiable man of my acquaintance, but that is all. I have nothing either to hope or fear, and nothing to reproach him with. Thank God, I have not that pain. A little time, therefore, I shall certainly try to get the better."
With a stronger voice, she soon added,
"I have this comfort immediately, that it has not been more than an error of fancy on my side, and that it has done no harm to anyone but myself."
"My dear Jane,"
exclaimed Elizabeth,
"you are too good. Your sweetness and disinterestedness are really angelic. I do not know what to say to you. I feel as if I have never done you justice, or loved you as you deserve."
Miss Bennet eagerly disclaimed all extraordinary merit and threw back the praise on her sister's warm affection.
"Nay, this is not fair. You wish to think all the world respectable and are hurt if I speak ill of anybody. I only want to think you perfect and you set yourself against it. Do not be afraid of my running into any excess, of my encroaching on your privilege of universal goodwill. You need not. There are few people whom I really love, and still fewer whom I think well. The more I see of the world, the more I am dissatisfied with it. And every day confirms my belief of the inconstancy of human characters and of the little dependence that can be placed on the appearance of either merit or sense. I have met with two instances lately. One I will not mention. The other is Charlotte's marriage. It is unaccountable. In every view, it is unaccountable.
My dear Lizzie, do not give way to such feelings as these. They will ruin your happiness. You do not make allowance enough for difference of situation and temper. Consider Mr. Collins' respectability and Charlotte's prudent, steady character. Remember that she is one of a large family, that as to fortune, is a most eligible match. And be ready to believe, for everybody's sake, that she may feel something like regard and esteem for our cousin.
To oblige you, I would try to believe almost anything. But no one else could be benefited by such a benefit as this. For were I persuaded that Charlotte had any regard for him, I should only think worse of her understanding. Then I now do of her heart. My dear Jane, Mr. Collins is a conceited, pompous, narrow-minded, silly man. You know he is, as well as I do. And you must feel, as well as I do, that the woman who marries him cannot have a proper way of thinking. You shall not defend her, though it is Charlotte Lucas. You shall not, for the sake of one individual, change the meaning of the principle of integrity, nor endeavor to persuade yourself or me that selfishness is prudence and insensibility of danger, security for happiness.
Okay, thank you. So I'm wondering what you all notice in this conversation between the two of them about their relationship. So friendship as sort of filling up what the other lacks. Yeah, and she gets close here to that effusive sentimentality. My dear Jane, you are too good. Your sweetness and disinterestedness are really angelic. I do not know what to say to you. I feel as if I had never done you justice or loved you as you deserve. But it's so sincere. It's so honestly and deeply felt. I don't think that it comes across as sickly sweet, but as the genuine outbursting of right, of genuine admiration for the superior excellence of her sister. Elizabeth really does think that Jane is better than she is. I'm not sure that readers universally agree with her. I think if you polled a room, most people would say Elizabeth by far the more dynamic, engaging, charming character. But she really does believe that Jane is her superior. And I think that's an interesting element in friendship. The relationship or the tension or the paradox between equality and hierarchy. How much do we need the friend to be our equal? And how much do we need the friend to be our superior? And Elizabeth, in this respect, I think, believes that Jane is her superior. We see later Elizabeth will receive a proposal from Mr. Darcy, which she will reject out of hand because she believes many things about Darcy. One of them that Darcy has actually contributed to the separation of Bingley and Jane. So she's going to reject him. Mr. Darcy delivers a letter, one of the great letters in the novelistic tradition, one of the great letters in Jane Austen's corpus, explaining everything. And as she's reading this letter, we get into Elizabeth's head, into her mind, and we hear her basically say the same thing about Jane. To Jane herself, she says, there could have been, she's thinking about why Darcy would do this, why he would try and separate the two of them. She thinks to Jane herself, there could have been no objection. All loveliness, excellence, cleverness, right, intelligence, insight that she possesses. There could be no, right, there would be no reason to object to Jane herself. So I think she does actually believe this.
I would argue.
Yeah, so, right, she possesses the virtue of candor, which does mean something different for Jane Austen. We normally think it doesn't mean, well, you know, right, I'm candid with my friends, which means I tell them that I don't like their outfit, that I'm really direct and blunt and straightforward. Sorry, but that's girl candor. but that I have this generosity of opinion. I mean, really what it is, it's charity. I have this charitable openness towards others that prevents me from too quickly making snide and cynical judgments right about their worthiness. She's going to charitably expect the best from others. Now, there's a naivete in some of this, and Elizabeth is the antidote to that. But Elizabeth is too cynical.
Yeah.
Right? She's too cynical, right? And she's too confident in her own judgment. Because eventually she's going to be proven wrong. She's going to be very, very wrong about Mr. Darcy and Mr. Wickham. This woman who's trust in her own judgment. We also see in that conversation that they have about the letter that Caroline Bingley sent, which they talk back and forth. I love this scene because this is Jane and Elizabeth are engaging in textual hermeneutics. Right? This is sort of, you know, in the art of interpretation, which is exactly what we're doing here. I would note, so this is, I think, Jane Austen's brilliance. She's going to give us female friendship, in which we've got women engaged in textual interpretation, right, in reading a great book, so to speak, together. But she's so realistic that she's not going to give us two women sitting down, you know, in a country house in England in their free time, you know, reading for fun Aristotle's Politics, right, and discussing it in depth. Because there are novelists in her own day that are doing things like that. Right? They're going to give us these long, super dull, boring conversations about philosophical discourse between two characters sitting there very dryly speaking, as no human being has ever spoken to any other human being, right? Ever. Right? So Austen's not going to do that, but she's going to show us the same attentiveness to language and the same intellectual vitality that you have to have to do that kind of thing. But she gives it an extremely realistic setting. Okay, so we get this exchange between Elizabeth and Jane here. Jane asks, I think this is so great, because this is what a teacher does in a classroom. Right? What do you think of this sentence? "My dear Lizzie," said Jane as she finished it, "is it not clear enough? Does it not expressly declare that Caroline never expects nor wishes me to be her sister? That she is perfectly convinced of her brother's indifference, and that she suspects the nature of my feelings for him. She means, most kindly, !, to put me on my guard. Can there be any other opinion on the subject?"
Okay. Yes.
What Jane assumes is, with great candor, that Caroline has the best of intentions. That Caroline is genuinely trying to warn her of the dangers most kindly. So there is this, right, there's this virtue in Jane, and I think that Elizabeth intensely admires, but as you point out, there can be another opinion, and we actually will find out that Elizabeth is right in this case. Right. Elizabeth, savvier, more cynical Elizabeth, gets that there's something else going on here. Right. Yes, there can. "For mine is totally different. Will you hear it?" So again, that the willingness that they have to challenge each other, Elizabeth, for all the elevation that she gives to Jane, too angelic. "I've never before really loved you and given you the affection that you deserve. Right? She actually makes it a question of justice. Like, right, there's a just level of loving the friend according to their excellence. But also, I'm going to give you my opinion. And Jane says, most willingly. And I think we have every reason in the world to think that both of them are intensely sincere here. Willing to exchange and willing to accept. You shall have it in a few words. Miss Bingley sees that her brother is in love with you and wants him to marry Miss Darcy. She follows him to town in the hope of keeping him there and tries to persuade you that he does not care about you. Jane shook her head. Indeed, Jane, you ought to believe me. No one who has ever seen you together can doubt his affection. Miss Bingley, I am sure, cannot. She is not such a simpleton. And here, right, classic Elizabeth. Could she have seen half as much love in Mr. Darcy for herself, she would have ordered her wedding clothes. Oh, brilliant. But the case is this. We are not rich enough or grand enough for them, and she is the more anxious to get Miss Darcy for her brother, from the notion that when there has been one intermarriage, she may have less trouble in achieving a second, in which there is certainly some ingenuity, and I dare say it would succeed if Miss De Burgh were out of the way. But my dearest Jane, you cannot seriously imagine Miss Bingley tells you her brother greatly admires Miss Darcy. He is in the smallest degree less sensible of your merit than when he took leave of you on Tuesday, or that he will be in her power to persuade him that instead of being in love with you, he is very much in love with her friend. And then if we thought alike of Miss Bingley, replied Jane, your representation of all this might make me quite easy. But I know the foundation is unjust. Caroline is incapable of willfully deceiving anyone. And all that I can hope in this case is that she has deceived herself. Okay. So, your point about Jane being this actually pretty active moral agent, this active moral thinker, I think we see that really clearly here. I have to note that they're working from different assumptions about the characters of the human beings that they are talking about. And Elizabeth, cynical Elizabeth, is going to, as she told us earlier, don't be afraid of my, or, well, yeah, later in the story, but earlier in the packet. don't be afraid of my running away into any excess of universal goodwill. There are few people that I love and even fewer people that I think well of. The more I see in the world, the more I'm disappointed with everyone. So she's primed to think that Caroline Bingley is up to something. And she is, no, it's actually, she's absolutely right this time. She's absolutely right. She reads Caroline better. Though in Jane's defense, we are actually told when, during this visit to Netherfield, and Jane and Elizabeth are both there, Jane is feeling well one day, well enough to come down one day, and the narrator tells us, Elizabeth had never seen Caroline and her sister so well disposed and acting so well than when they were around Jane. And in fact, she herself is almost inclined to like them because of the way that they treat Jane. But then as soon as Jane is gone, they fall back into their old ways. So Elizabeth has actually seen more than Jane has. They act differently towards Jane than they do to Elizabeth. And we also are told, yeah, that right, Elizabeth has powers, quicker powers of observation. She says she does see more keenly, but she trusts too much in those observations and in those powers. And Jane is willing to challenge her. Right? Jane is willing to push back against Elizabeth's very firm and very persuasive interpretation of what's happened. So I think that we see in this relationship between the two of them, so we see Elizabeth's admiration for her sister's superior excellence. Since that Jane really is her moral superior. We see their willingness to challenge each other, to disagree with each other. Their openness in confiding with each other They want to talk to each other. I didn't point this out, but that longer section we read begins because Jane goes to Elizabeth and says, I really wish that Mom would stop talking about this. Which way she says this very politely, with great decorum, right, because she's a 19th century heroine. But I can't get Mom off my back. Help me. So there's this shared confidence that the two of them have that I think unites them deeply. Now, we also see in the two of them this shared commitment to virtuous behavior and also to moral convictions. We get little glimpses of this throughout the novel, and it's kind of hard to extract this, but I just want to describe a few scenes where we see Jane and Elizabeth actually mutually exercising virtue together. So not simply a friendship of, right, I admire your virtue and you admire my virtue, and right, isn't that really lovely, but actually we're united in virtue together. I think this is one of the ways, right, that Austen saves us from effusive sentimentality. Because if it was simply a friendship of, right, oh no, right, oh you're wonderful, oh no, you're wonderful, right, oh no, 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 right, you're wonderful, right, it's repulsive, and it would feed into all these sentimental stereotypes about female friendship that are percolating in the background in the 18th and in the 19th century. Right? But Austen is not going to do that. So she's going to show us moral action between friends. So at one point in Pride and Prejudice, we've had Mr. Collins mention, described a little bit, he's actually the heir to the Bennet estate. Right? So the Bennet estate is entailed, which means that it has passed down from one male heir to the next. And the plan for the Bennets was always to have some sons, or maybe just one son. But five daughters later, they realize that this is not going to work. So the estate is going to go to Mr. Collins. Right? Mr. Collins is going to come and visit the family and sort of make amends for the fact that he is, by law, the rightful heir. So Mr. Collins comes, and we've already had, of course, Elizabeth's description of him. What?
Pretty accurate.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yep. She's absolutely right. Right. He's a ridiculous, silly, pompous, conceited man. He's hilarious. Right. He's one of the great characters in Pride and Prejudice. But there's this moment in which Mr. Collins takes out a book of sermons, Fordyce's, and he's a clergyman. Right. Should also add that. He takes out a book, and starts to read this out loud. And naturally enough, the younger girls are bored with this. And so Lydia, the youngest sister, very rudely interrupts Mr. Collins. This is right. So this is the kind of moral dilemma in Jane Austen. It's just not right. Do I give the armor, my own armor, to my friend and encourage him to go fight out in the battle for myself? Do I, as the rightful heir, the rightful political heir, show friendship to God's chosen heir? What do I do? No, it's what do you do when somebody interrupts somebody else? Right? And I don't say that flippantly or lightly, because that's where real virtue is shown for most of us. And we need the high and we need the excellent and we need the extreme, but we also need this. We need these little moments here. So Lydia rudely interrupts him. And the narrator tells us, quote, she was bid by her two eldest sisters to hold her tongue. Two eldest sisters. They're not Jane and Elizabeth, but they're united in that description. Right? The two eldest sisters, actually, right, stepping in, intervening to protect the guest, right, the object of hospitality from the rudeness of the host. That's an incredibly, it is incredibly virtuous thing to do. And it's, I think, made all the more remarkable by the fact that this is not something that their parents ever do. Right? There's no effort to correct Lydia. Lydia is more or less allowed to run wild. Mr. Bennett sits back and makes very witty, sardonic remarks about his daughters, which would be super appropriate if he were a novelist writing about them, but he's actually a little suspect as a father. And then, of course, Mrs. Bennett is no help whatsoever. Right, she's only going to encourage them. She tells Mr. Bennett, you know, I loved a red coat in my day as well. She's just as men crazy, just as officer crazy as her youngest daughters are. So the parents aren't doing this, and here in this moment we get Jane and Elizabeth stepping in and doing right. And there's another very small moment when we see this ability in particular, I think, in Jane, actually, because we tend to think of her sort of weak, but we see this ability to exercise virtue, and this is when she refuses to stay longer at Netherfield. Right. And we do have to put that decision in context of 18th and 19th century, and remember that for a woman, and especially for a woman of the gentry, marriage to a man of means is the way of obtaining temporal happiness, security in her life. And this is, her mother is encouraging her to go after him, to scheme after him, right, to do all that she can to get him in her clutches and keep him in her clutches. But Jane refuses to allow any other, she doesn't make any excuses, say, I need to stay a little longer, I'm not quite well. But instead she resolves to leave. And the narrator tells us of this decision, which again I think is probably a little bit astonishing if we're thinking about virtuous action. Jane was firm where she felt herself to be right. So the decision to leave the house and not stay longer is actually a question of rightness. This is the right thing to do. And a question of rightness that demands the necessary firmness. The firmness in right doing. We're going to see this same firmness in Elizabeth when she refuses Mr. Collins' proposal. So this is Mr. Collins' plan to make up for the fact that he is the heir, is to marry one of the daughters. That'll sort of smooth things over a little bit. At first he thinks Jane's beautiful, right? Jane is the prettier one. But Mrs. Bennett tells him, no, right? She's taken, but my second daughter. I know of no one. And suddenly Mr. Collins is thinking, oh, yeah, right, Elizabeth. Actually, Elizabeth's quite lovely. Right, so he proposes to her. And again, you have to think, Elizabeth would be the lady of the house in which she has grown up in. So it would remain in her family, and then her sons would become the inheritors of this estate. So in a way, it would sort of set right what has been set wrong by the entailment. But she refuses him, very firmly so. So they both have this incredible firmness of principle. And then we see that even in that discussion that the two of them have, right, when Elizabeth says, you shall not, for the sake of one individual, right, change the meaning of principle or integrity. So there's an insistence on right principle. And Jane herself actually is agreeing with this. Jane herself also exercises and is bound to right principle, but she's reading the characters differently. She's assuming different things about the nature of Charlotte and Mr. Collins. And then we also see about how human beings work. In that conversation, Elizabeth says, men designedly make women think that they feel more for them than they do. Jane says, that would be very bad. That would be very bad if men were out there deceiving women. But I do not think there is as much design in the world as that. So there's that shared sense of right and wrong between the two of them, that shared sense of there are principles by which we ought to act, by which we ought to understand the world around us. But a different interpretation of particulars. Okay, so I think they're united in their general moral sentiment, but divided in particular interpretations. And that is very much shaped by the nature of their characters. And the fact that they are two very different women. As much as they are similar, right, they are very different. And I think we see this in the way that they speak to each other. Right? We know that I've already mentioned that Elizabeth has more quickness of observation and less pliancy of temper than her sister. Right? So she's sharper. She's not as willing to kind of go along. And Elizabeth herself tells us, when she tells Jane, right, "You wish to think all the world respectable and are hurt if I speak ill of anybody. I only want to think you perfect, and you set yourself against it." Right. So Jane has this sort of openness to all. Elizabeth has a kind of exclusivity. Though that might, at least with respect to friendship, might be why we sort of see Elizabeth as the more dynamic character and maybe the better friend, because of the issue of taste and friendship. Right? What kind of people do you choose to be your friends reveals a lot about who you are. And the more discerning you are, the more particular you are about the kind of friend that you have, right, reveals something about your own virtue and your own excellence. I love everybody. Hey, that's nice. But good for you. But I love the few who are truly excellent. And Elizabeth certainly thinks that she knows who the truly excellent are, and she does sometimes. And she's certainly right about Jane here, right? But she has that fine discernment and the exclusivity of friendship. Friendship is not friendship for everybody. Friendship is friendship for the few. This sounds all very very serious. And it is very serious. Right? Friendship is a matter for Jane Austen of, I think, of the highest concern, you know, the concerns of what it means to live a happy life, and the concerns of what it means to be a good human being, and what it means, I should add before moving on, right, what it means to grow virtuously yourself. Because we'll see, or you see, if you read the novel, she said, you see that actually in the end, Jane and Elizabeth both become a little bit more like each other. Elizabeth becomes a little bit more candid, or we should say at least, she begins to grow in the intellectual humility that is necessary for candor. Right? Because in order to be candid, you have to have some humility about your own. The accuracy of your own judgments of others. Say, I could be wrong about this person, and because I could possibly be wrong about them, I'm going to assume the best of them. So I think we see her grow in that. And we also see Jane grow into Elizabeth's wise cynicism. She's going to reject the overtures of Miss Bingley. Of Caroline, Caroline sort of wants to kind of become friends again, and Jane says something like, "That's nice, we can never be to each other what we once were before." Elizabeth is like, "Right, yeah, good for you, Jane, that's the closest thing to bitterness and resentment that I've ever heard from you. nice work, nice work." So they've become more like each other. The virtue of the friend rubs off on you. And you grow, you maintain your discreteness, but you also grow into a kind of likeness. So it's very, very serious business. But for all of its seriousness, I think as anyone who has ever had a friend knows, friendship is not exclusively this serious thing in which those involved sit around soberly talking about the nature of the good or about each other, right, as their second self, with undying devotion. Cicero actually says, while unvarying seriousness and gravity are indeed impressive, it must be very impressive to be serious all the time, yet friendship ought to be more unrestrained, genial, and agreeable, and more inclined to be wholly courteous and urbane. Friendship ought to be more unrestrained. The lack of restraint in friendship, this might more particularly characterize those friendships that aren't as characterized by so much hierarchical difference. It might be a little hard. As Glenn pointed out, we don't actually get Patroclus and Achilles before. It's a little hard to imagine them sitting around joking and laughing with each other. Maybe they did, but we don't really get that unrestrained friendship in them. But for Cicero here, friendship is more unrestrained, right? It's genial, it's agreeable, it's courteous, it's urbane. So I think that that friendship, if we look at it from its linguistic perspective, it invites not only confiding language, right, the sort of I want to talk to you about the most serious things, the highest things, or those things that at the very least are most serious and important to me. But I also want to talk to you playfully, and maybe even do both simultaneously. Talk to you about the most serious of things in an incredibly playful way. And friendship makes possible, and I think encourages that kind of speech. And we see this very much, right, in the way, of course, that Elizabeth speaks with Jane. We see her playfully bantering with other people when she mentions that had Miss Bingley seen as much love from Mr. Darcy as Jane has seen from Bingley, she would have already ordered her wedding clothes. And her plan that, marry Bingley and Darcy's sister, and then, that first marriage will just sort of facilitate a second one. Right? It'll kind of work. Okay. So we see her playfulness towards others, but we also see her playfulness towards Jane herself. I just wanted to read it a couple of little zingers that Elizabeth gives to Jane to get something of a flavor of the way that she talks to her. Okay. So early in the novel, Jane confesses that she does indeed like Mr. Bingley. It's a private conversation. Their mother is not there, so private exclusivity of friendship. Elizabeth generously concedes, well, he is certainly very agreeable, and I give you leave to like him. You have liked many a stupider person. So, yeah, again, she doesn't tend to cushion the way that she speaks to Elizabeth. Okay. So there's this teasing, joking tone. It's also a personal and inside joke. We don't know, we as readers, we don't know who these suitors are. We don't get along, right? Austen doesn't suddenly flash back into Jane's former lovers. We don't know who they are. Instead, by just allowing the statement to sort of stand, we get this cozy relationship between the two sisters. And again, that sense of sisterliness, that sense of siblingness in friendship. We have a past. We've seen things together, right? We have memories and we have experiences that unite us. And so I can, through playfulness, right, I can actually allude to this past that binds us together, right, that holds us close. At one point, we actually see Elizabeth laugh at Jane's candor. She sort of pokes a little bit right about at her virtue. There's this moment when Jane is trying to clear everyone of speculation, everyone of wrongdoing. Nobody presumably has done anything wrong with respect to Mr. Darcy and Mr. Wickham. And Jane says, interested people have perhaps misrepresented each to the other. And in amusement, Elizabeth asks, and now, my dear Jane, what have you got to say in behalf of the interested people who have probably been concerned in the business? Do clear them too, or we shall be obliged to think ill of somebody. Right. So, too good, angelic, I never loved you as you deserved, but what have you got to say in behalf of the interested people? Do clear them, or else we might actually have to do this really horrible thing of having to think bad of somebody. Okay. So there's a sort of, there's this playfulness in the way that she addresses. And Jane responds here really, I think, wonderfully. Laugh as much as you choose, but you will not laugh me out of my opinion. So I am open to your laughter, but I am not weak enough to be crushed or ultimately or easily led by this playful teasing that Elizabeth engages in. I should point out that when Elizabeth speaks to her this way, it's in private. There's not but public shaming, public humiliation of her sister. This is the confidential chat of deep and profound intimate friends. So to conclude, this is a novel that abounds in friendship. The two sister friends marry men who are actually also friends. Men who are friends of a very different character, we learn. So we have friendship, lots of friendship, and friendship of the other. Not quite level of Ishmael and Queequeg otherness, but of character, right? Different characters. And of course, as I mentioned, that Jane and Elizabeth are able to live in close proximity to each other. Samuel Johnson says that friendship, like love, is destroyed by long absence. So Austen actually ensures that the distance will not cause permanent separation. There's going to be no divorce between these two sisters. So Jane and Elizabeth, they can't quite say with Ruth, where you go, I will go, or you stay, I will stay. Actually, I think they're pretty close to that model of biblical friendship, with all of its depth of feeling. But Jane and Elizabeth are not simply deep feelers. They're capable of exercising virtue based on strong principle, and they both possess remarkably good sense. They are rational beings. So I think in showing us female friendship, Austen is less interested in exploring this is what it means to be a woman who is a friend, this is what it means to be a man who's a friend, right? But this is what it means to be a friend. In his Sermons to Young Women, which is the sermon, the collection of sermons that Mr. Collins is reading in Pride and Prejudice, the author, James Fordyce, praises female friendship. Happy, he writes, beyond the common condition of her sex, is she who has found a friend indeed. Open-hearted yet discreet, generously fervent yet steady, thoroughly virtuous but not severe, wise and cheerful at the same time. For Fordyce, the good friend balances virtues, open-heartedness and discretion, fervor and steadiness, wisdom and cheerfulness. Jane and Elizabeth have found such a friend in each other. Certainly, the spiritual happiness of the life to come far surpasses any earthly happiness. But the possession of such a friend is one of the very great enjoyments of this present life. And by showing us the great enjoyment that Jane and Elizabeth have from their own friendship, I think that Austen hopes to persuade her readers to desire that kind of friendship for themselves. Thank you.
Jane Austen's slow-moving world of grace and civility has changed into the fast-paced, turbocharged world in which most of us live today. Nonetheless, we need friendships. We are, as someone put it, hardwired to connect. Austen's heroines and heroes offer an invitation to slow down, to listen to others, to make the time for deep and enduring relationships. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.